That brings us to some newer treatment options that are more universally available. I will just bring up briefly the high-intensity focused ultrasound, which is also another non-extirpative surgical treatment option, but not widely available, unfortunately, in many medical centers across at least the United States. What has been growing in popularity and availability are volumetric image-guided radiofrequency ablation. We currently have two FDA-approved devices in the United States. One is the Accessa, which is a laparoscopic approach, which re requires general anesthesia and basically a laparoscopy. And then this other procedure that was FDA approved much more recently in 2020, called the Sonata system, which is a transcervical fibroid ablation treatment. The goals of both are similar. It's to achieve thermal energy and temperatures in target tissue to about 95 to 105 degrees centigrade, to a level to achieve basically coagulative necrosis. So we know that cell death occurs around 50 to 60 degrees centigrade, why then do we super physiologically heat these areas? It's to induce this coagulative necrosis, but to induce coagulative necrosis in an area just beyond where the electrode is touching. So if we want to have larger tissue effects and larger areas that are impacted by the thermal heat, then we have to achieve that at higher levels. And how this differs a little bit from UAE, I think, which is something that gynecologists are really familiar with, is that whereas UAE is kind of a global therapy for the whole uterus, which causes ischemia, these RF treatments, these RFAs for fibroids, are really more targeted towards the specific fibroids in the uterus, and instead of ischemia, cause coagulative necrosis focally. So I point that out just because I think they seem like potentially similar procedures as far as volume reduction and symptom improvement, but these RFA treatments don't seem to incite the infarction-related post-embolization syndrome that embolization is known to do. So basically, what happens to the tissue over time and after treatment, using RFA, which is low voltage, high frequency alternating current delivered through needle electrodes, is that over time, the fibroid itself, which is largely made of extracellular matrix, undergoes coagulative necrosis and changes in sort of its substance and what it feels like. So not only does it shrink by volume, and there's various studies showing changes from like 40 to 70% volume reductions, but about 50% volume reductions by 3 months up to 12 months. These what feels like sort of a fibroid, which feels often can feel like a softball or a baseball consistency, then goes on to feel more like a marshmallow consistency, which I think is what really produces the symptom relief that women experience. And it's interesting, after I've done many cases of these, I do have patients who, who wake up and do say, and it's rare patients, that they feel, less impingement or less pressure already, because I think that tissue is not firm and leaning up against organs like the bowel or the bladder, even immediately postoperatively. So we can see improvements in those sorts of symptoms rather rapidly. But some systematic reviews have looked at, lots of data together. In 2019, Linda Bradley published a nice meta-analysis of about 1,300 subjects who underwent laparoscopic and transcervical RFA, and found significant improvements in health-related quality of life, symptom severity score up to 36 months out of treatment. And women were back to work, or patients who underwent these treatments were back to work within 5 days. That was a mean return to work. And fibroid volumes reduced with 30 to, like I was saying, 30 to 60% at 12 months, and up to 70, 80% at 6 months, and then up to that beyond 12 months. The reintervention rate, I think, is also something to consider when we're comparing these different options. And it looks like around 3 years post-treatment, maybe about 11% of women may ultimately need some other treatment options. And I put that in context that women at 3 years, other data just comparatively at that time frame, is similar to myomectomy. Women undergoing lap myomectomy, about 70% of women at about 3 years may need, who undergo uterine artery embolization, may need reintervention. And then about a quarter of women who undergo endometrial ablation, for example, after at 3 years need reintervention. So that 11% reintervention rate is pretty low compared to other treatment options. Complications, however, I think overall in all these studies that we've been analyzing and the AGL is putting together, and my caveat is that I chaired a practice committee examining all of this data, that be on the lookout for that publication soon. But one thing that I think should be noted is that though complication rates really appear to be pretty low, and when complications occur, they look to be more minor, complication rates at this stage, at this early stage of our following of these longer term outcomes, have not really been systematically collected. But as far as large published systematic reviews so far, there have been no reported deaths after an RFA. That certainly shouldn't be our standard, but that's good to know. And very few visceral injuries. One thing to add is that ACOG, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, in June of 2021 actually updated the 2008 Management of Symptomatic Uterine Leiomyomas ACOG Practice Bulletin, and actually stated, you know, synthesized the data around lap RFA and stated that it could be considered as a minimally invasive treatment option for the management of symptomatic fibroids in patients who desire uterine preservation, and are counseled about the limited available data on reproductive outcomes. So that brings me to the, you know, point about reproductive outcomes, because I think many women who do want a uterine preserving option also want it to preserve the potential for future fertility. And though the data, we again are sort of at the level of case series and case reports, at least with our experience with post-RFA pregnancies and fertility, I think that the reproductive outcomes, though limited, have been reassuring. So Jay Berman, published in JMAIG in 2020, a case series looking at pregnancies from two RCTs and six cohort studies, as well as commercial data, and found some very positive findings around pregnancy. In his series, there were about 26 full-term live births, both delivered by C-section and vaginal deliveries, a 13% miscarriage rate, but what they found was no preterm deliveries, no uterine ruptures, no placental abruptions, no IUGR or placenta accretas had been reported in this series. But again, that is, you know, we take that with a grain of salt as far as the data around that, since we don't have registries right now of reproductive outcomes. So these are those pregnancies and reproductive outcomes that were indeed reported in a few studies. But there's much more to come, including data out of Germany from Sarah Brucker, who also has found about a 35% clinical pregnancy rate after RFA treatments. So long and short of it, to tie that all up, I think it's really just important for gynecologists practicing physicians to understand the various options that are available to women. In my own practice, we've started to incorporate multiple modalities of treatments for women. You know, fibroids are not one size fits all. You know, not every patient and every uterus is different. And we recently presented at the Society of Gynecologic Surgeons a study, an analysis out of the ULTRA registry, which is a long-term outcomes registry, looking at using combined Excessa with myomectomy. and found that in our series of 34 women who underwent concomitant procedures, that it looked very safe. And there was a really high satisfaction and improvement in symptoms and quality of life with combined procedures. So I think that now that this is more, the procedure is more commercially available, we'll start to see people and surgeons combining various procedures. So though these clinical trials compare one versus another, the real life, you know, case uses of these may, you know, show up to be that we end up doing various things to patients, hysteroscopic myomectomy, laparoscopic myomectomy, as well as RFA. And I think we're just going to have to look at the safety and longer term outcomes of that. But at least in our initial series describing this, it looks to be a compelling option. I think it's also really important, though, when we discuss any new technology that is out and becomes popularized very quickly, and because of the need, you know, among our population and our quote unquote market, our patients who are demanding and wanting minimally invasive, non-extirpative procedures, these procedures are becoming quite popular as, but the technology, I think we don't have the long-term data yet. You know, it looks very compelling from what we have as far as 3 to 5 year data from their pivotal trials and their initial clinical trials, but those were under perfect conditions, right? Fibroids that were treated in the clinical trials were less than 7 centimeters. Uteri were generally under 14 weeks. And when we're out in real practice in the wild, if you will, people are attacking and doing fibroids much bigger than may have been done or performed in clinical research settings. And I will share that we had recently published in the Journal of Minimally Invasive Gynecology an unfortunate case of a woman who underwent uterine necrosis after a laparoscopic RFA of a 12 centimeter uterus.